have an index of them. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, he was not, you know, successful to complete it.
Yes. He passed away?
Yes.
In the middle of the way, that's right. Okay.
But he, you know, compiled something like 11,000 names of the books that were not mentioned in Adveria.
Yes.
And another point that we should mention regarding his personality is that beside having, you know, relationship with Shia scholars, he had good relationship with, you know, Orientalists.
Orientalists, that's right.
Because, you know, he was in need of, you know, have access to the libraries all around the world to get the, you know, manuscripts.
That's right.
So, for example, he had a relationship with Fuat Sezgin, mm-hmm. the Orientalist from Turkey.
Yes.
And some other figures.
Yes.
And he was in need of traveling too much, you know, and this traveling for a scholar, especially in his, you know, old age is very hard.
It's
and,
a backbreaking
you know,
work,
taking
that's right.
too much energy of him. So he take all this burden to help late Allama Amini and late Aghazi Tehrani to, you know, collect the, let me say, the encyclopedia of the books of Shia School of Thought and also the encyclopedia of Al-Ghadir.
That's
that
all right.
Is trying to collect every information regarding the event of Al-Ghadir.
Yes, you know, just accompanying these two scholars in the magnum opus like Az-Zariya and Al-Ghadir is enough.
Yes.
Muharriq Tawatawi, these are really, you know, hard works, especially when he goes to different libraries across the world. He tried to make a checklist or the list of the manuscripts for that library, like the Amir al-Mu'minin Library in Najaf, we said, Astana-Quds Razavi Library in Iran, in Mashhad, you know, and some other libraries in Baghdad. Even he went to Hejaz, you know, and some did some research over there, Turkey, Shiraz, and Tabriz in Iran. Really great, outstanding works. And there is a foundation in Iran called Bunyad Muhaqqiqat Tabatabai, which is really famous, you know, especially in doing researches on the books and the manuscripts. The offsprings of Muhaqqiq Yazdi are still active in this field of study in that foundation. Okay, anything missed? Sheikh Madavish, okay.
I think one of the good works being done by Muhaqqiq Tabatabai that for our listeners, they can benefit from this work if they get familiar with this is Fazail Amir al-Mu'minin li-Ibn Hanbal. We know the meaning actually is the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin li-Ibn Hanbal. Actually, this is a controversial topic. Mm-hmm. You know, for one of the great imams of Ahlus Sunnah to compile the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, it's actually a kind of controversial topic.
Okay.
What kind of methodology he does in order... Actually, this is not the work that he authored.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the great codicological work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So three very important things he did upon this work. First of all, he wanted to elaborate on the topic of the work.
That's right.
So what do we mean by the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin? He elaborates on this.
In the views of Ibn al-Hanbal. Is it so?
Yes.
Okay.
Saying that when we talk about the merits of a personality, we mean his advantages, morality, the way people would talk about his behavior, and good things that he would do during his life.
That's all right.
This is his elaboration on the topic. So when we talk about the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin, these are the stuff that we are going to cover and include in the book. Yes. Second of all, he goes and tries to trace back this book from the time of Ibn Hanbal till the 7th century. So he says, when we go and we find out the books which were in charge of covering the titles and the books of their time in all centuries, after Ibn Hanbal, we see the name of this book being attributed to Ibn Hanbal.
That's all right.
This is a very perfect job. Why?
Really,
because right now, somebody may say, who said that Ibn Hanbal has done this work?
Mm-hmm.
So he traces back the time of publication of the book from the time of Ibn Hanbal till the 7th century.
Century, that's
yes.
Right. Okay.
And the last thing that he tries to do in terms of this book actually is the value of this book
mm-hmm.
in the eyes of the authors, and different manuscripts being collected in different libraries. So I think right now we feel really comfortable to quote Fazail Amir al-Mu'mineen from the book of Ibn Hanbal. Why? Because we have such a great, powerful work behind us.
Yeah.
So if you quote something from this book, if somebody comes up saying that, okay, who said this book?
You made this out of your own mind for Amir al-Mu'mineen.
That is a great job he has done, and we have to really appreciate.
That's all right.
This is one of the works. I just wanted to elaborate on the value of the works that he has done.
That's
and the
right.
contribution that he did. Upon the library of Shia.
Okay, really, what a fruitful life this outstanding man had, you know, and how much sacrifice on doing research in the books and writing down and making lists out of this precious legacy of the Shiite world. May Allah bless him and may Allah protect all the Shiite bibliographers and codicologists all across the world. Ramadan 7th, 1416 was the year that he passed away. He was buried in the main yard of Lady Masuma Holy Shrine in the holy city of Qom, the city from which this program is produced. May Allah bless his soul, and may Allah bless the soul of all the Shiite scholars all across the world. And thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyaniya.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahtabi, thank you very much, brother.
You
for
are
a nice
welcome.
Elaboration on the life and works of Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Tabatabai. Thank you much, dear listeners, too, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets in major cities across the country on Monday to denounce the U.S. complicity in the protracted Saudi war on the Arab country. The biggest rally was held in the northwestern city of Sada, where thousands carrying Yemeni flags and chanting anti-American and anti-Saudi slogans poured into the streets. The protesters say Washington is behind a military and economic war on the nation and is prolonging the war and siege of Yemen. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, a senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, says the United States spearheads the devastating Saudi-led military aggression and brutal siege against his country, stating that Washington is complicit in the crimes that the Riyadh regime is committing against the Yemeni nation. He said the U.S. has been killing Yemeni people and destroying vital infrastructure for the past 7 years, stressing that the Riyadh regime and its regional allies would not have been able to do anything without Washington's support.
We saw in the last days only Saudi Arabia carried out in one day 65 attacks on different civilian targets in Yemen. This is how we see the Americans' complicity, because they do nothing to stop the Saudi war. On the contrary, they encourage this war to continue.
The organizers of the protest said in a statement that Washington was misleading the world about its stance toward Yemen. The statement said the administration of President Joe Biden continues to provide Riyadh and its regional allies with military and political support, enabling them to press ahead with their onslaught and commit crimes against the people of Yemen.
This war has to end.
And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The U.S. president made the pledge back in February this year. He touted the move as part of efforts to restore an emphasis on human rights. Biden, however, said Washington will continue to support and help Riyadh. The peace activists who hailed his announcement are now dismayed at his administration for going back on the promise. Back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. A State Department spokesperson defended the sale as, quote, fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen.
We see that there is no will to end this war on Yemen. Moreover, we see also the Americans are not asking the Saudis to lift the siege on the Yemeni harbor and the Yemeni airport in Sana'a. Therefore, they are the direct contributor of the siege imposed on the population of Yemen.
President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he's taken much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. Wouldn't that embolden those officials to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in the most literal sense?
The Genoa U.S. Indian Industrial School, a government-run boarding school for Native Americans located on the edge of town in Genoa, Nebraska. Decades after its closure in 1934, researchers have unearthed the bleak history of this institution. They confirmed that over 100 Native American children died at this school, using newspaper archives and school newsletters to identify them, because official records were destroyed when the school closed. Search for the graves of children is in progress at the site of the Genoa school. Researchers said the true death toll is probably much higher. The passing of the Civilization Fund Act in 1819 by the U.S. Congress authorized the government to establish residential boarding schools and relocate Native American children by force. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of children were sent to boarding schools operated by the government or churches across the U.S. However, some never returned home. Students were victims of harsh punishments and hard labor, and many of them died of diseases. One descendant claimed his great-grandmother was blinded while a student at Genoa, probably by having lye soap rubbed into her eyes as punishment. While they were removed from their families and homeland, children were prohibited from speaking tribal languages in a bid to subdue or eliminate the Native American culture. The narrative has an uncanny resemblance to Canada's residential school system. In the 19th century, Canada also established mandatory boarding schools for Indigenous children. 150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against children. This year, remains of 215 First Nation children were discovered at the site of a former residential school near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners through the 20th century.
And just imagine somebody coming to your home and taking your children from you when they're 5 years old, 4 years old, and taking them away, mm-hmm. a away from your influence, away from your understanding, away from your culture. That's what happens with indigenous people in the United States and in Canada.
One of the tactics used by the U.S. federal government to destroy the culture, religion, and way of life of Native Americans was the establishment of boarding schools. The discovery in Genoa school is only a tiny part of the immense hardship colonial settlers inflicted on Native Americans. Back in the late 1700s, American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. When Christopher Columbus reached the Americas in 1492, 10 million indigenous people lived in what is now the United States. By 1900, there were less than 300,000. Another atrocity against Native people in America is the implementation of the Indian Removal Act. In 1830, the U.S. federal government endowed itself with the right to take Native-held land east of Mississippi and forcibly relocate Native people from their homes in Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee to Indian territory in what is now Oklahoma. In a mass atrocity remembered as the Trail of Tears, tens of thousands of Native Americans died or were killed after fleeing their homes in terror.
The immigrants never had any land when they got here, and whatever they got in terms of land, they stole.
Native Americans were expelled from the lands they had lived in for generations. They were victims of wars, mass killings, and discriminations while the U.S. government destroyed their cultural traditions. Even today, discrimination and oppression against minorities exists in the U.S., as racial discrimination is systematic in American society. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is now designated as a terrorist organization by Britain following the Friday announcement of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. The move brings Britain in line with the United States, which designated Hamas a terrorist group in 1995, and the European Union. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel justified the decision by arguing that it was not possible to distinguish Hamas's political and military wings. She claimed that Hamas has a significant terrorist capability and access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group uses its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip against Israeli aggression. Patel also highlighted the importance of a ban to protect the Jewish community. The British official, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The British Parliament will vote on the proposals next week. If Patel's bid succeeds, showing support for Hamas in Britain could be punished with up to 14 years in prison. Israel applauded the news, with its foreign minister, Yair Lapid, saying the move was a result of joint efforts between the British and Israeli regimes.
And, of course, it was all in cahoots with Washington as well, apparently. The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who announced this decision, made the announcement in Washington, not even in London. So you can see the Israelis, the British, and the Americans were all involved in this.
The London's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades. This move has drawn widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measures at Israel's request, adding that it's an unjustified aggression against the Palestinians and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Iran has also denounced the British measures. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hamas has slammed the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people,
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917 during the First World War, which laid the foundations for the entity of Israel. The declaration is seen as a catalyst for the 1948 Nakba, where more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned the ban on Hamas, describing the move as an unjustified attack on Palestinians who have been subjected to the most heinous forms of occupation and historical injustice as a result of the Balfour Declaration. Following the blacklisting of Hamas, the resistance movement reacted, saying in a statement that, instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims. It also added, resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right guaranteed by international law to people under occupation. Hamas also urged its supporters to condemn the UK's move, as it described Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, forcible displacement of Palestinians, the demolition of their homes, and the siege of more than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip as terrorism.
Well, implicitly, I guess it's saying okay to Israeli crimes, but no different from they've been saying okay to Israeli crimes since 1917. So in that sense, it's nothing new.
Based in Gaza, Hamas is a resistance group against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Hamas and Israel clashed most recently in a deadly asymmetrical war in May, during which the Israeli regime killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, through its continuous bombardment of the Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days.
The cost of living in the UK surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
Now, there's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market. So, of course, prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
There are two aspects of all of this. Inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. On the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation. After Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on a, certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
A new MinPress News study based on Department of Defense documents can reveal that U.S. weapons manufacturers have sold well in excess of $28.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began, including 20 separate deals inked during Biden's presidency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Despite Pledge, Biden Leaves Tap Open, Approving Billions in Arms Deals to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. The biggest profiteer from Yemen's destruction has been aviation giant Boeing, which brought in $13.9 billion in sales over the period. Next comes Lockheed Martin, which has signed 62 separate contracts with the kingdom since March 2015, worth in excess of $7.4 billion. Third on the list is missile expert Raytheon, which has cashed in on the violence to the tune of $3.3 billion. Boeing's spot on the top of the pile comes in large part thanks to a massive $9.8 billion contract signed last year to maintain and modernize Saudi Arabia's fleet of 269 McDonnell Douglas F-15 Eagle fighter jets, including changing out hardware components, updating software, and improving weapon systems. 2020 was a great year for the company as it also secured a $1.97 billion fee to provide 650 SLAMER cruise missiles to the Saudi government. Lockheed Martin has scored big with the Saudi Navy, making billions of dollars, including a nearly $2 billion contract to build four warships. In addition, it secured enormous sales of Patriot missiles and laser and infrared technology. Black Hawk helicopters made by its subsidiary, Sikorsky, treated by the DoD as a separate entity, were also in high demand. Meanwhile, many of Raytheon's largest deals include air-to-ground missiles, guided bombs, and widespread logistical planning and technical support. The top 10 war profiteers supplying the Saudis with arms are as follows: Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Sikorsky, PKL Services, S&K Aerospace, DynCorp International, AITC 5 Domains, JVL 3 Communications Core, and Kratos Technology and Training Solutions. Reading the approved sales, what becomes clear is the depth of U.S. involvement in virtually every aspect of the Saudi military. Of course, there are direct arms shipments, but there are also contracts for helmets and a wide range of equipment, intelligence services, maintenance arrangements, and even for English lessons for Saudi pilots to help them better use their aircraft features. While the offensive is widely known as the Saudi-led attack on Yemen, in reality, U.S.-made aircraft armed with American missiles and bullets maintained by American crews and flown by pilots trained by American operatives hit targets selected by U.S. intelligence. All of this is done under political and diplomatic protection by Washington, which blocks attempts by regional organizations to mitigate the destruction and shield Saudi Arabia from international consequences. This, in other words, is an American attack on Yemen. It is inconceivable that the Saudi-led coalition could be carrying out its attacks without the support of these companies. Kirsten Bayes of the Campaign Against Arms Trade, CAAT, told Mint Press via email, "Western-made weapons have been central to a bombardment that has destroyed schools, hospitals, homes, and created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It is long past time for arms shipments to the Saudi-led coalition to be brought to an end," it added. In total, 86 U.S. companies have profited from sales to Saudi Arabia since its intervention in Yemen, including household names like General Electric, Booz Allen Hamilton, and Honeywell. The full list is also available in the accompanying spreadsheet. Counting the value of the contracts is relatively straightforward. Counting the dead is not. One recent estimate, however, put the cumulative death toll from the conflict at over 560,000. If that is the case, American companies have made about $50,000 in sales per death. The Saudis have deliberately targeted Yemeni infrastructure, including hospitals, farms, and sewage plants. Oxfam calculated that attacks on health and water facilities have taken place on average every 10 days since the conflict began. It is beyond doubt that American arms are in part of the blame for the carnage. In the first 2 years of fighting alone, pieces of Raytheon weapons were found at 12 different sites where civilians had been targeted. Meanwhile, fragments of Boeing Joint Direct Attack munition bombs were identified in the wreckage of a marketplace that had been targeted, killing 107 civilians, including 25 children. Not to be left out, 500-pound MK-82 bombs built and supplied by Lockheed Martin were used in an infamous 2018 attack on a school bus, killing 40 children, and a 2016 strike on a funeral hall that left 240 dead. The company's unexploded cluster munitions also littered the country, likely causing casualties for years or decades to come. The United States is the only major Western nation not to have signed the 2008 convention banning the production and use of cluster bombs. For almost 7 years, Saudi forces have maintained a naval and aerial blockade of Yemen, cutting it off from the outside world. The closure of Sana'a Airport has been devastating for Yemen, driving up the prices of life-saving medicines and humanitarian aid, and preventing mercy flights with tens of thousands of critically ill Yemenis who need emergency treatment abroad, Atayeb told Main Press. Weapons manufacturers are well aware that their profits live and die on the decisions made by legislators. Lockheed Martin's latest annual report makes that explicit. In a section entitled Other Risks to Our Operations, the Bethesda, Maryland-based outfit noted, international sales also may be adversely affected by actions taken by the U.S. government in the exercise of foreign policy. Congressional oversight for financing of particular programs, including the prevention or imposition of conditions upon the sale and delivery of our products, the imposition of sanctions, or congressional action to block sales of our products. For example, they state the U.S. government has imposed certain sanctions on some entities and persons as described in the risk factor below and could act in the future to prevent or restrict sales to other customers, including the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Unsurprisingly, then, the military-industrial complex has lobbied the government hard to continue supporting the violence. Ronald L. Perilux, Jr., an executive with Lockheed Martin, denounced a wave of patently false hostile media reports about Saudi atrocities, described human rights laws as a significant irritant, and argued that the best thing to do is help the Saudis finish the job in Yemen by providing them with the benefit of our experiences, the training of their forces, and probably replenishment of their forces. His counterpart at Boeing, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Jeffrey Kohler, agreed, arguing that weapons transfers were actually a force for stability. When you sell somebody a big platform like an F-15, you build a 30-plus-year relationship with that Air Force, he said. If the public had their way, U.S. involvement would cease. A 2018 poll found that 82% of respondents wanted Congress to act to halt or decrease arms shipments to Saudi Arabia. American law already bans the sale of weapons to human rights-abusing countries, but this legislation is constantly ignored. Conservative estimates suggest Washington is supplying military aid to almost three-quarters of the world's dictatorships. According to data from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, around three-quarters of all the Saudi military purchases come from American companies. Much of the rest comes from Great Britain. Riyadh's top 10 suppliers since 2015 are as follows, with percentage of total sales in parentheses. United States about 74%, United Kingdom 12%, France 4%, Canada 2%, Spain 2%, Germany 1%, Italy 1%, Switzerland 1%, and Turkey 1%. The British figure is dominated by BAE Systems, which has closed deals worth over $24 billion with Saudi Arabia since it began bombing Yemen, documents obtained by CAAT show. CAAT's base told Mint Press, BAE Systems UK-made Typhoon and Tornado aircraft have been central to Saudi Arabia's devastating attacks on Yemen. BAE Systems also has 6,300 employees in Saudi Arabia supporting the Saudi Air Force as part of the British-Saudi Defense Cooperation Program, and we know it sends weekly shipments by air to Saudi armed forces from its own private airport. Thus, while a figure between $28.3 billion and $63.1 billion is already monstrous, it tells only part of the story. The likes of Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin were already supplying the Saudi government with weapons long before the conflict began. Boeing since 1945, Lockheed Martin since 1965, and Raytheon since 1966. American arms companies continue to supply other members of the Saudi-led coalition with similar arms. That number will continue to rise as deals negotiated with the Trump administration come to fruition. Therefore, the true extent to which the military-industrial complex is profiting off some of the most extreme suffering in the world is still not completely clear. All that is known is that the Saudis pay in petrodollars and the Yemenis pay in blood.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Back to Reality. We are glad to have you all on the show. Over here, we discuss about different but interesting topics which we can relate to our daily life. And I'm your host, Hassanain, and today we have got two special guests with us. Assalamu alaikum, brother Sayyid Mohsen.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Welcome to the show, and can you please tell our audience where you're from and what's your field of study?
I'm from Pakistan. I'm currently pursuing my PhD in Islamic economics from the Hawza Ilmiyaqom.
MashaAllah. And we also have Brother Sayyid Abdullah with us. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me. I am from Iraq, currently residing in Australia. My field of study is Quran and Hadith.
Dear listen, so without any further delay, let's start with our main discussion. And the topic for today is our different thoughts on afterlife.
Especially with us as Muslims, we programmed with the evidence idea that I prove it to me. So if you say, so we have two people. We have people who believe in the afterlife.
Uh-huh.
There will be an afterlife. Now, also believing in the afterlife, people divide because each one would have his own afterlife. And people says, no, we die and this is the end of things.
Okay.
So I say, if you know, I think of it logically, that it could not be logical that you see this entire universe and the people that, especially the people that live here.
Yeah.
And some people get to commit so many crimes,
mm-hmm.
yet they cannot get punished for it. They won't get punished for
mm-hmm.
it. And so many people do so much good, they don't get rewarded for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how is that fair? How is that just? So it makes me wonder that there has to be a day and a time where me and you are and will be held accountable for our actions.
Okay. I just heard about the logical explanation, but how can you talk about this? You can, like people say that we're accountable of what we do in this world.
You are accountable in this world. If you kill someone,
mm-hmm.
okay, what would be a just treatment or a just punishment to that? Killing you? Killing
yeah.
you, I'm just taking your life.
Uh-huh.
But you, when you kill someone,
okay.
when you kill someone, you take a life from this existence
okay.
and the after effect, the shock waves that creates.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I kill you, it's not going to do that justice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, if, for example, someone steals and you put him in a prison forever for you know until he dies, you give him a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
That's not justice.
So
that's
you're trying to say there should be a way
retribution
where justice is fulfilled.
Exactly. So this person who got killed and he died innocently, what's his sin? What did he commit? He needs to be, you know, at least compensated for what he lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that who killed him needs to be punished for what he committed. Now, such a system does not exist on earth.
Let me put the explanation which brother had in an example. You know, our life is like a film.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a famous statement.
Okay. Yeah.
Or a sentence that life is just like a film. Now, imagine a film that Hollywood makes. Yeah. In that action movie or I don't know, any kind of film that they make, you have gangsters, you have other people, you have police, you have some innocent people who are oppressed by these gangsters and the police. What comes in your mind when you're watching the movie? All the time you think there must be a revenge. Someone must take a revenge. And the oppression, the injustice keeps going on and on and on. And if the movie finishes with gangsters doing their own like injustice and the oppression,
uh-huh.
and the ones who were oppressed by these people, they do not get any revenge, what would be your remarks on that movie? You will remark that it was, you know, a boring movie, there was no good end, there must be some revenge. And all these kind of things.
That's what people
yeah.
think nowadays,
yeah.
right? Like the movie ended, everything just finished.
Yeah.
Life ended,
so
everything just finished.
The point is, what's happening in the life? We can see throughout the history till now, there is a lot of oppression. We had the protest of 99% against one person in Wall Street. In the other parts of the world, we see the same thing. We see, you know, racism in America, in Britain, in other parts of the world. Yeah, what's happening with the black people? And they haven't reached to the justice yet.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear listeners, welcome back to Back to Reality. And the topic for today is our different thoughts on afterlife.
There must be some ending. Now, this is connected to two things, basically, which is provided in Islam. Number one is it goes to the time when Imam Mahdi will come. and he will bring the justice. But that justice is for the people who are living at that time. Mm-hmm. What about the people who passed away?
Yeah.
So the justice which Imam Mahdi will bring under this concept, I'm just giving a logical answer to you, that justice is for the people who are living at his time, mm-hmm. that he will change injustice to the just ones.
Okay.
And the whole world will be in a state of peace.
Mm-hmm.
What about those who have passed away previously in the history?
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to get their own justice? You know, there is a famous saying, "You too, Brutus."
Okay, so
what did Brutus did?
No,
what did Brutus did? He killed a guy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but what was the punishment? Nothing. Yeah, it wasn't the way. So who's gonna give that justice to them? Who's gonna talk about the, you know, the unjust things which they have done? So therefore, especially in Islam and other religions as well, I'm not talking about the atheism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you look at Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, other, you know, there are other religions as well. They all talk about hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
There is a heaven, there is a hell.
Yeah, but some people talk about karma.
Now, obviously, that's again something after death. Yeah?
Uh-huh.
That's again something after that, that according to their own, you know, actions which they had in their life. You see, again, according to the actions which they have the consequences, they will face those consequences after the death.
Yeah.
Now, the point is, those who say we do not believe on what's happening after death,
uh-huh.
there's a simple answer which was given by the fourth Imam. Imam Zain al-Abidin has said to one of such people, he said, like, if there is nothing after the death, then obviously I have lived a life curiously. Obviously, I was very much careful about my actions. I didn't harm anyone. I have a good life. But my life was tougher than yours.
Mm-hmm.
If we both die and there was nothing, then none of us has lost anything.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but I was trying to be a better person in this world for
mm-hmm.
the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And you just lived freely. That's the only difference. But if there was something, what's going to happen? Then obviously I'm obviously in benefit. I have a beneficial life.
You miss all the joys in your current
life. That's what I said. It's not everlasting.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the hereafter, that's everlasting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're leaving something for in order to get some everlasting thing. Whereas, you know, khalidina fiha, we have this verse that they will abide, they will live forever in
yeah.
the heavens or in the hell. Obviously, both things have been said in the Quran. So basically, after that, we think, obviously, we have in our sources as well, especially being a Muslim, that we've been transferred to this world where we are. And after this, the death will transfer us
mm-hmm.
to another place. For example, you know, when the child is in the womb of the mother,
yeah.
obviously, when he comes out that womb, he's not comfortable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he cries a lot, and that crying is the sign of life. If he comes out of the womb, he's been delivered. If he does not cry, that's a sign of, you know, a danger for the child.
Yeah.
So he has to cry. He feels uncomfortable coming out of that zone that he had, comfort zone, which he was in the womb of the mother, and there he was. He has his own world in the womb of the mother. When he comes out, there is another world for him. Similarly, when we die, we are basically converting to another world, which
okay.
is known as barzakh, or obviously there are other stages as well.
Let's just stop here and take a short break over here.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Dear listeners, welcome back to Back to Reality. And both the brothers, listening to your answers, somewhere or the other, are you guys trying to say that the whole idea of afterlife is just to serve the justice?
No, it's not just to serve justice. Not only to serve justice, but also to reward people. See, this life itself, it's a test,
mm-hmm.
right? Imagine you go to an examination room, and they give you an exam paper. You answer everything else, and they say to you, that's it. There's nothing. It's like, well, what's the whole purpose of this whole exam and everything? Like, no, nothing. We're just here to have fun with you.
No, like learning
it doesn't
might
make
be a purpose.
It doesn't make sense, right? So once you graduate, once you go to the test, you want to graduate, you want to get a job. There's an incentive in it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So logically, it doesn't make sense that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, forget about Allah, whoever made this universe or this universe itself, is such a complex and perfect system. Yet by itself, it has no aim, it has no goal. that you live this life, you go through problems, you go through hassles, you go through so many tests of this life, and then that's it, that's the end. It makes absolutely no sense, whether you're Christian or Muslim or a Jew. It doesn't make sense. What do you mean? Like, I'm here and just, why? And then I'm going to go to disappear, you know,
you have come into this world, just live like humans, live happily, just don't harm
others.
Okay,
if you want to live that kind of life, you still, since as long as you're here, you know how Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, Rahim Allah imri'in arafa min ayn wa fi ayn wa ila ayn. He says, may Allah bless you who knew from where, in where to where. You need to understand where you're going. There has to be a purpose. You can be a perfect Muslim. That's what we are required to be, as perfect as we can. Never harm anyone. Never do anything wrong. This is our requirement. It doesn't mean we haven't got a purpose, an end. Mm-hmm. So that's got nothing to do with anything. So what I'm trying to say here is that at the end of the day, me and you, doesn't matter of our faith or religion, this life has got to have something more than just me dying and disappearing into thin air, or believing in what Buddhists believe in, reincarnation.
Yeah, what's the problem
with
that? Like, your purpose is like just living happily in this world, you know, spending some good time.
Well, let me ask a question from Hassanain. That if you say someone thinks like the way you're saying, like just come here and live like humans and that's it, then why you're making these laws? Why you're stopping people from living freely? You know why you don't allow people to drive in the streets, like, you know, on 160 kilometers speed? Why you do not allow people to do whatever they want? They should be free for in order to kill. I don't know. Sorry to say, you know,
that's
there's raping. There's all the things, the habits that the humans or animals have. So let them do. Let them kill each other. Let them like fight on the food.
That's
you know?
Necessary because
look,
we have
look,
to
look,
respect
look.
Each
when
other's
you
food
when you say when you say where does it has come from?
We humans when decide that.
No. You decide about yourself then. Don't decide about myself. You know, that's what the freedom means, isn't it?
No.
When we talk about the liberty. So therefore, when you're making, let me just close this up with this statement that when you're making some laws, when you're bounding people to live according to what humans have made as a law,
mm-hmm.
what is the purpose of it? Its purpose is to stop people from having injustice, oppression, and they should live a better life. Why? Because there are the consequences of the actions. Now, this human law which you made, you want people to be bound through this, you give respect to this, it's because so that the next generation should be dealt fairly. That's why you make it.
Everyone has got liberty, we are living in a freedom, so I won't let you do anything which will spoil my freedom. Like, you know,
so this is what they're saying, where did you get this idea to have such liberties?
You know, all humans, you know.
Where did the humans get that from?
No, there are some humans who do not think like this.
Air?
No, it's a mutual understanding.
No. Even mutual understanding, it doesn't come by itself. Now, if I bring a bunch of people together, have you seen Squid Games, that TV show?
I heard about it.
No, see, this is, life is like that. If there is, you know, you can bring people together without anything in their minds pre-programmed.
Mm-hmm.
We as creatures will only look after our own benefit. What pleases me, what benefits me.
No,
even
but it's from our intellect,
even,
right?
No. That's what I'm saying. Even if it's on your own expense. If I have to kill you to get what I want, I will do it. But this mutual understanding that you say, it's not a mutual understanding. It's an embeddedment in your system that you automatically, when you're at age of 5, 6, 7,
mm-hmm.
8, 9, 10, you know stealing is wrong. Killing is wrong. How do you know these things? You never been taught anything.
It's human intellect.
Human intellect
says that I shouldn't spoil your freedom.
Human intellect
I shouldn't harm you.
Why isn't animals have this human intellect that you have? Why only you have?
No, that's a completely a different topic.
No.
About
you have a brain.
Right,
they have a brain. How come your brain can comprehend things, but animals can't? The idea is there is someone that put these systems in your head,
mm-hmm.
that told you right from wrong, and whoever programmed you in this manner,
uh-huh.
obviously he has a reason for you. He has a point and a plan to get to.
Thank you so much, brothers, and thank you so much, dear audience. That's all the time we have for today. And today we're discussing about our different thoughts on afterlife. Until the next program, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, lati umara again, let us see daylight again, once again.